Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. We kicked off there with Here Comes the Summer from the Undertones, of course, followed by The Rant, which I think is peculiarly suited to tonight's show. That's from Jack Outerworld and the Quantum Singularity. And then we had Space Station Number 5 from the first Montrose album, Sammy Hagar there, hacking away on the guitar. Well, you've got the virtual me again this week, because the real me is once again off treading the boards at some vast and ancient country pile somewhere in Radnorshire, which means that I've put together another of these little pre-record shows for you with a bit of music and some thoughts. I don't really like to put out pre-recorded interviews when I'm not actually around to deal with the chat box and stuff, because it seems to just spoil some of it. Talking of which, hi to all of you in the chat box and to all of you that I know are listening outside the chat box. It's great to know that you're all there. So next Thursday, once again, is another of those voting days, it would appear. This is one of the joys of having a Thursday radio show, is that you get to hit all of these various referendums and elections turn up on show night, even though I personally couldn't really give a toss, of course, because I haven't registered to vote and wouldn't be giving my power away to any of these people in the first place. Nonetheless, tonight I propose to have what is for me a bit of a rare visit to the world of what passes for, I guess, orthodox political discourse or debate. Because I got sent a link for a movie which was about an hour and 10 minutes long called Brexit, the movie. And I thought, hell, I've got an hour to waste, I'll give that a look, because I haven't been paying any attention really. Well, for various reasons that will probably actually become clear as we go through what I hope to say. And like it does, you've got this kind of sixth sense nowadays, only for languages that are being used and claims that are being made, you know, implications that one thing, this thing's really, really bad, and therefore the other thing's actually quite good. And you sort of get a sixth sense that's kind of running whilst you're watching various propaganda outings of one sort or another. And I found mine was being regularly agitated whilst watching Brexit. I was aware that there was quite a lot of important stuff being said, even though I'm also aware that the EU, the kind of vehicle which is the reason for it all being said, is, I think, of less importance. So I decided to watch it again, and the result has been a few things that I think are probably worth thinking about, because it seems to me that most people are aware and have been aware for a long time that the EU is, perhaps not all that we'd hope it had been. And from that, it might be possible for people to start realizing that maybe some questions need to be asked about governments that are closer to home. Funnily enough, actually, when I'd finished watching Brexit, I decided that just for the sake of balance, like, I'd go and see if I could find a movie from the Remain option. And, when I put in, you know, Europe Remain, the movie or whatever, into YouTube, the thing that came up top of the list was the Brexit movie again. There really is very little about the other side of the argument. Do you think someone's trying to tell us something? Certainly from what I've seen, the Remain position is a hard one to sustain. It is. But I do find myself wondering whether it is, as I say, actually the EU specifically that is the challenge, or is it government generally? And I think some of the answers to those questions can be found in the Brexit movie, although I'm sure the people that did it weren't necessarily imagining that as an outcome. My own feelings about Europe really are that we imagined it into being, and I reckon we need to de-imagine it. I don't think it's really a question of being in or out of it, is it really? You don't have to look at it in too much detail to see that it really is in a bit of a state. It's definitely a wagon with one or two of its wheels missing, and possibly some of the spokes of the remaining wheels looking a bit unsound. So whether we as a supposed individual nation get in or out doesn't seem to really make too much difference to me, because you're still going to have this collapsing entity on your doorstep. Something far more fundamental than one nation simply leaving, I think, probably needs to be done. But thankfully, that's really not my problem. I think it's important, given the fever pitch that the arguments seem to have been reaching, that there is no them, you know, there is only us, and we are without doubt the ones who need to sort this out. Us and them, competition has been demonstrated to be a losing strategy, and as I say, the EU debate really has been a classic dissent-bearing distraction from all of the issues that are actually central to everything that's going on. So, you know, as long as the financial system is the way it is, everything else is six of one and half a dozen of the other. Nothing more, nothing less. There is currently no actual economic model, beyond the obvious, you know, grab what you can as fast as you can, which I suppose at least is understandable. And besides, the system is designed, it is designed to be infinitely manipulable and is structurally guaranteed to collapse. So whilst we're everything's based on that, you know, what's loosely called a financial system, any other decisions that we make I don't think are going to help us at all, because that is at the core of the whole deal. Along, of course, with the unaccountable corporate structure which brought it all into being, which it would seem is framing and enacting all of the legislation it requires. And it would also seem that men and women are failing to hold, you know, the officers of one sort or another to account. As long as those two things are the case, things are just going to be as they have always been. The money and the corporations with which governments are intimately intertwined are absolutely at the centre of nearly everything, and if we change them, most other things would change as well, I'm pretty sure. And as for voting to change anything, well, because it's always on a bloody Thursday, we've covered that often enough, probably a bit more later, but I don't personally recall ever joining the EU, and I don't recall asking to be governed at all. Although, you know, obviously I accept that if I start infringing somebody else's rights and offer to make no recompense, then I can probably expect some sort of third party involvement. But apart from that, I really would expect to be left alone. As we shall hear, the people who put the Brexit movie together are obviously of a completely different school of thought. So I don't actually believe that men and women can vote to leave or stay. I don't believe anyone who counts cares what men and women think either. And it must be said that the arguments for leaving are more numerous and more pressing than the suggested reasons for staying, but I think the whole thing's basically a distraction anyway. And as I say, for me, these various arguments that question the validity and desirability of the EU are also perfectly valid questions to point towards governments in general. Oh yes, the sheep, I forgot. I've got my own collection of digital sheep out there who've recently moved in, and you can hear them discussing the European issue out there. So just before we get into the meat of the thing, the whole thing was written, presented and directed by a character called Martin Durkin, who apparently is a TV producer and documentary film director. In the Times 2014 power list, he is called the Michael Moore of the Right. He's the founder and CEO of a thing called WAG TV, and of the various prizes he's won for his wonderful films, he's most proud of the Free Enterprise Award, given him recently by the Institute of Economic Affairs. Previous winners include F.A. Hayek and Margaret Thatcher. So, that's the man that made the film. And actually, there's quite a lot of his narration contains the bits that most interested me. Most of the people that they're kind of quoting in it, interestingly, are described as variously journalist and author and journalist and historian, journalist and author. There are a few politicians as well, but actually I was quite relieved to see there weren't too many of them. Nonetheless, it's clearly basically an opinion piece. So Mr. Durkin kicks off with, we must fight for our independence, for the right to determine ourselves, the laws under which we live, and for the freedom to shape our own future. This is clearly central to the man. But are we really fighting for our independence by simply selecting to remove one of the many, many layers of government that have been introduced over the years since I was around? There really weren't so many of them, you know. Europe wasn't there. Well, Europe was. The EU wasn't. Not even the EC, its precursor. Everybody seems to think Nigel Farage has said this is the single most important political decision any of us will make in our lifetimes. They quote a guy called James Dallingpole as well, as journalist and author, this is the most important voting decision that any of us are going to make in our lifetime. And I think far more important political decision might be to choose to seek ways of governing ourselves rather than being governed by the people who've been doing it for the last decades, centuries, whatever, because it's clearly only got us into the kind of trouble of which the European Union is merely the biggest and latest example. And boy, oh boy, we do have some pretty big examples around nowadays. They quote at the beginning of the movie a lady called Janet Daly, and she's listed as a journalist and an author. And she says, what really matters is that you should have the power to remove those who govern you. Clearly the problem there is that we don't have the ability to remove the people who govern us as far as we're concerned in Europe, because we don't actually elect those particular people in the first place. I still think it's a bit of a mealy-mouthed phrase, though. What really matters is that you should have the power to remove those who govern you, because I think a more honest phrase would be perhaps to replace those who govern you, because you can't actually remove them, can you? All you can do is replace them with another bunch, and I would venture to suggest that precedent has shown that basically this process unfailingly leads to more of the same. I can't say over the last 50 years how it's changed very much as I've been watching it. I'd have thought that what really matters is, at the very least, to try to avoid putting the negligent, the criminal, and the sociopathic into positions of responsibility. I think we might further observe that having more or less all positions of authority held by folk who are all three of those things is proving to be a pretty poor strategy, no matter where. The narrator says, we're being asked to give up the right to govern ourselves. What are we being offered in return that can possibly be worth it? How many of us are governing ourselves? How many of us are being governed? But I think that if there is a point to the whole in or out debate, then this is probably close to it. A few men and women operating in honour are demonstrating that it is possible within UK PLC to assert the right to govern and take responsibility for ourselves. It's pretty rare, but it is being done. And although the natural right to do this might survive the enlarged European Union project, it seems to me that the practical right to do this might well be disappeared. I think that my instinct is that the kind of systems we've got in this nation possibly are fixable. Possibly we do need to be governed. Possibly if we had more honest people and a more honest financial system, we'd have something that, broadly speaking, might work at least a bit better for us and might well be holdable to account. I suspect that the European thing, very difficult to hold those guys to account. And the way things are going, we'll see, one nation's police force policing another nation. At that point, it gets a lot more difficult to do the kind of things that we've been doing. Nonetheless, I think that one of the reasons I like living here and don't feel the urge to go and live in one of the many other European countries in which I apparently have the right to live is because I feel we do have, we are still maintaining the right to do that here, I think. That's one of the things that might finally disappear unless we're very careful. I think it might finally disappear anyway, but not while some of us are trying to do it, eh? As it is, really, I'm not sure that I can see how surrendering to governments variously in London and Cardiff and the individual counties is in any way exercising what he calls the right to govern ourselves. Even to register to vote is to cede the right to govern ourselves by authorising others to govern us. So the words are either misplaced or misleading, I think. Bit of a propaganda alert, I suggest. But it's a bloody good question, isn't it? what have we got in return for ceding these rights? The narrator points out, quite rightly, I suppose, that for a democracy, well, actually, maybe, maybe not, for a democracy to function, there needs to be transparency. We, the people, need to know how the system works. Whether we have any actual functioning democracies where we could test this statement, of course, is open to question, I think. It might be nice to find a democracy that's functioning properly so that we could see whether transparency was one of the key elements, but I don't see any transparency. I don't see any democracy. Not really. Not anyway. We the people need to know how the system works. Well, yeah, that'd be great too. That's a really good idea. And again, you can see the point is that we the people don't know how the European system works. We don't know lots about it, but I feel there's an implication there that, you know, we sort of maybe do know how this system works, but we don't, do we, you know? Do people know, by and large, that cash is created from a man's signature, printed for pennies by a private corporation who is trading for profit, stolen, and then lent to the government at interest, which is never published? Do we think people understand that? It's pretty central to the whole game. Do people know that to register their vote is to hand it away? It seems to me that most people that hasn't occurred to, although many more people have noticed that they are registered keepers of their vehicles, and so can be more easily convinced, shall we say, that they are somehow a registered keeper of the vote. Do people understand that everything in the public world is an offer of contract? That it's just that, an offer. That it's not necessarily, at that point, any kind of obligation. Do people understand that, do we think, you know, in terms of how the system works? Because if everything is an offer of contract, then that is how the system works. And I don't think many people do understand that at all. How many people, I wonder, know that there is no law obliging them, or anyone else apparently, to pay income tax? Not very many of them. And in fact, even when you do bring it to people's attention, they won't believe you. It's quite a funny one, that. I enjoy that one. And of course, you know, how many people know that the City of London is an entirely separate estate with its own parliament, whose MPs are elected primarily by corporate interests? And the bigger the interest, the bigger the say in who gets selected. I don't think many people know that either. And given that that particular parliament has a representative in the elected parliament, whose job it is to remind the elected chamber of the interests of the corporation in the city, I think it's something that people do need to know if we're going to claim that they understand how the system's working. But there you go. According to Mark Littlewood, who is apparently from the Institute of Economic Affairs, everything's okay. According to him, people might not understand exactly how the functions of the British Constitution work, but they get the gist of it. Oh, yeah? Yeah, do they? Well, according to him, I suppose they do get his version of the gist, which is that once every 5 years, we go down the school hall, we put a cross on the ballot paper, they're all counted up, and the chap with the most votes wins. Well, that's a nice tidy summary of it, isn't it? But, you know, again, if we're giving our vote away by registering it, and we are, as I say, if you like, only the registered keeper of that vote, then we need to be asking whose vote it is that's being cast, don't we, really, in order to know anything about what we're doing at all. Might it be true that a vote for any suit at all is in fact a vote for the system as a whole? Whoever wins, I suspect that that's probably the way that it actually works. And are we absolutely certain, for that matter, that the votes are all counted? Or that all the counted votes are valid? There have been, over the decades, many, many examples of electoral fraud that have been written about in detail in Private Eye, and the numbers and varieties of election fraud are increasing, I suspect, as time goes by. And in all likelihood, we are only catching some of the more obvious ones. Perhaps not even that, really. And is it even strictly correct to suggest that the chap with the most votes wins? I mean, I know at a kind of regional level that might be the case, but when we consider how governments are formed as a result of this process, where somebody chooses who it is, it's going to be the Chancellor of the Exchequer and all that kind of stuff. And the government that gets in doesn't necessarily get the biggest number of votes, do they, either? I mean, you know, every time we get a coalition, and we've had a few, my impression is that there should have been another election, and there wasn't, which means that something's gone a bit awry in the process. And anyway, who amongst we the people can genuinely say that we understand the horse trading that goes on under the circumstances where one of these coalitions is being formed? I mean, it's all a lot more murky than these people are making it out to be, I think. And, I mean, are we happy with the idea that putting a cross on a piece of paper is the beginning and end of all our responsibility in this democratic process? Is that what democracy boils down to? A pencil cross once every 5 years on a piece of paper. Well, our man appeared to be quite happy with it. But perhaps it is more properly our task to hold to account these people who claim to be acting in our name. In fact, it seems that, you know, really, that's what's going to have to be done. If there is going to be a solution, it's going to be something along those lines. So, he had us believe that for a democracy to function, there needs to be transparency. He also believes that for a democracy to function, we need to know who's running it. And again, I can understand this point in connection with the EU, because the EU is particularly opaque as far as this goes. There's some very amusing bits in the movie where he goes around showing some photographs of these various bearded, suited characters and trying to find anybody who knows who they are, and nobody does. So I'd agree, the EU is particularly opaque as to, you know, who is actually doing what. But I'm really not sure if anyone knows who, if indeed anyone is at the helm of the good ship Britain. You know, after all, politicians come and go, don't they? They come and go. But the administration remains. And I understand that often the same man can advise successive governments for many years. So where does the power in our democratic free economy really lie? Is it in any real sense any more accountable than the EU? And do we really think that our apparently elected so-called representatives domestically are effective in any sense whatsoever? One of my main problems with them has always been that I've not actually seen any of them do anything of which I could even vaguely approve. Do we believe that it's these people, the elected representatives themselves, who are drafting, enacting, and enforcing the ever-increasing tide of legislation coming from domestic government? And interestingly, according to Brexit, some 40% of the total legislation comes from our own government rather than from Europe. And we do know, do we not, that we have a bit of a reputation for making a meal of what comes from Europe. Well, known to be particularly predatory in the way we interpret these rules and then enforce them. But I'd say that the fact that some 40% of the laws, legislation that's being produced here, is being produced here and not in Europe, is a figure which alone would surely suggest that the EU is only perhaps a little over half the problem. Perhaps. Or perhaps I just haven't got a proper grip on it. And what about that parliament in the city as well? As I say, a parliament that has an officer in the nominally elected chamber whose specific job is to remind the elected body of the city's interests should they stray from the duties and obligations that are invisible to the population on whom this bunch prey? Got to ask yourself, haven't you? If one parliament's running, I mean, I personally think that our system very definitely looks like one thing and actually is another. I'm going to stop and have a couple of tunes now. And I know we've had this one fairly recently, but I'm going to play it again because it really fits in here and I really like it. It's my mate John Preston, the John Preston Tribute Band and a ruling class. And I'll be back with you in a few minutes or so. Or the me that's not here will be back with you in a few minutes. And that was Bugger the Bankers from the Austerity All-Stars, which I think says it all, doesn't it? That's a much simpler. No need to debate anything with that. Let's make it clear, shall we? Talking of which, Simon Heffer, not sure. He also was described as a writer of some sort, but I think he was something in journalism, wasn't he? I remember that name, reading it over many years. Anyway, he pointed out that the people we elect to go to Brussels have almost no power at all. They do what they're told, and they are fundamentally pointless, he says. Great seeing a lot of sense talked here, because, once again, I suspect that there's many, many layers of politics of which that is a completely valid description. These people could be doing something much more useful with their time than getting in our way and ripping us off. Because, of course, they are also very, very expensive, especially the European ones, but ours aren't cheap. So it seems to me that that basic point is true of all elected politicians. And it also seems to me that the men and the women that want such jobs are possibly the last folk to whom they should be given. It is, as I say, my hope that the recognition of the EU structure for what it is, and such recognition is now very widespread indeed, will cause people to start looking a bit more critically at the multiple systems that are being run closer to home. In fairness, no one in the movie specifically states that anything different is happening in local political systems from what's happening in the EU. But as I say, I think there's definitely a suggestive undercurrent that, you know, home styley government good, other government bad. And although they didn't get round to ever mentioning anything about this, we'd have to say, apart from those nice people across the pond, wouldn't we, our allies who persistently and seriously wage wars across the planet and have more of their population incarcerated than China. We've got a special relationship with them, don't you know? That's another good reason for leaving the EU. It's apparently the mighty Obama said that if we leave the EU, he's going to put us right at the bottom of the list for trade deals with the United States. Possibly a good enough reason in itself, actually. End of argument, really. Oh, yeah, then we get to this bit. I always love it when they do this. When they say, only last year we were celebrating the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, the founding charter of English freedom in Britain. He's got an interesting idea of freedom, this guy. But then he is the Michael Moore of the right, I guess. Let's say that old chestnut. Certainly not everyone would agree with him on that one. There's definitely some say that Magna Carta was merely some kind of feudal New Deal, really, you know, of some sort. And that, anyway, as a result of the global political manoeuvrings out of which Magna Carta and the Barons' Rebellion arose, the English crown has become, well, it became and has ever since remained a vassal of Rome. Well, fancy that. That's strange, isn't it, in the context of this? So, yes, chucking the Magna Carta in there casually like that, I always like that. He points out, he says that the history of democracy in Britain has been the history of taxpayers demanding the right to determine themselves how much tax should be taken from them and how it should be spent. The history of democracy in Britain has been the history of taxpayers demanding the right to determine themselves how much tax should be taken from them and how it should be spent. Well, is that what the people of Britain have been doing for the last few hundred years? Really? Demanding the right to determine how much tax should be taken from us is the history of British democracy, is it? I guess it's not too far from the truth, perhaps, in its way. But, curiously, as we know, you know, the tax itself is not legitimate even, let alone lawful. So we're apparently demanding to pay that which cannot be fairly demanded of us. Does give you a bit of a problem, doesn't it, when you start looking into some of this stuff? And what about this business of demanding to determine for ourselves how it should be spent? God, I've not seen any evidence of that happening at all. You know, are we really getting any say in how it's spent? I don't think so. As far as I can tell, all tax raised goes variously to pay the interest owed on a debt that arises, at least initially, from the creation of the currency itself. And it's a debt which is owed to us, you know. We're the real creditor. What kind of tax is that? And he'd have it that we're there demanding that we have control over how much of it's taken off us. It is completely crazy, isn't it? And the closer you look at it, the more crazy it gets. I don't really think it's fair to imply, if that's what he's doing, which he might not be, of course, that we get any more say in the level of tax or the use to which it is put when raised locally than when it's raised by the EU. I really don't. Peter Lilly is in there. He would have us believe that Britain is rather different from most other countries in that we said that no government should pass any law or impose any tax without first getting the authority of the British people. So, he says, it's a major thing that we can be taxed by other people without our say. Firstly, I mean, you know, the authority he mentions, such as it is coming about apparently through the use of a vote that isn't ours, and so is well questionable in terms of giving the people any say at all. And you know, secondly, I don't know about you, but I'm getting taxed daily by other people without my say. I mean, why should I have to pay 20p in the pound if I want my pasty warmed, for example? And would Sir like to pay the 20% VAT? No, Sir, bloody well wouldn't. But you have to, don't you? Asked if I want to be taxed indeed. That'll be the day. Perhaps things are different where Peter Lilly lives. Almost certainly are, in fact, different from where I live anyway. So, the narrator moves on to point out that we are now subjects of a vastly complex state machine run by anonymous officials who we didn't elect, but who have the power to impose upon us laws which we haven't debated and have no democratic means of repealing. Ah, sounds just like home, doesn't it? Complex state is most certainly is a democracy that is also a constitutional monarchy is quite a weird fish, which is what we've got here. Complex state, very definitely. Anonymous officials. How many of our government actors are willing to accept liability in their private, signed-for capacity? Because that's the only thing that really removes their anonymity. And as far as I can gather, people are trying pretty hard at this, and they're discovering, funnily enough, but nobody's willing to become anonymous and put wet ink signatures on things that require wet ink signatures, for example. And, okay, we might be able to see our lot on the telly occasionally. We might be able to hear them on the radio, unlike their European counterparts. But we know that they tell us what they think we want to hear. And we know they've been heard to say quite outrageous things when it's thought we are not listening in those glorious moments when they're wearing a microphone which somebody has carelessly not turned off. So just how unanonymous our lot are compared with the lot in Europe is, again, I think an interesting question and one worth pondering. But definitely the impression is that what we see is not necessarily what we get. You know, they tell us one thing, do another, say one thing when they're on mic, another thing when they're off mic, and by and large refuse to sign key documents, because key documents very rarely come signed. And as far as I'm concerned, that's pretty anonymous behaviour, as far as I can see. And also, as far as I can see, it is definitely trying to avoid accountability. And as for having laws imposed on me, which I haven't debated and have no means of repealing, well, you know, like the tax, that too is happening on a more or less daily basis and has been happening every day of my life, whether I've been in the EU or not in the EU. There might have been twice as many of them or three times as many of them since we joined the EU, but by and large, what difference does it make to me? I haven't got the time to keep up with all of that, nor would I want to, you know. So it definitely seems to me that along these lines, along the lines of these arguments, if the EU is a problem, then government, such as it is, and at least in its present forms, is a problem. That's what I think it is we're looking at here. The EU, as I say, is simply the latest and most up-to-date example of basically of something that we prepared much earlier. Oh, dear. And are any of these laws, these rules of society, ever repealed? Any of them? I did hear rumours that they were thinking of repealing a few, but as far as I know, once it's on the book, basically. The narrator gets on to the fact that these guys, since they're not directly accountable to the taxpaying public, EU politicians and bureaucrats, have understandably been more than generous to themselves in pay and perks. Yeah, well, unlike our politicians, of course, who are paragons of propriety. Always careful with the money, honest in their expense claims, never award themselves above average or excessive pay rises, etc., etc., etc. But again, it's just this kind of, perhaps it's just me picking up this implication of, look at that, these guys have been very generous to themselves in pay and perks, and not like us at all, you know. That's all happening because they're not directly accountable to the taxpaying public, you see. That's why that's happening. But if the taxpaying public are unaware that they are voluntarily paying apparently obligatory taxes of all sorts, and, I don't know, unaware that their vote is in some unfathomable sense being manipulated, would it make any difference if the EU actors were directly accountable? Because they'd be accountable to people who don't know what the hell's going on. And shouldn't we know what's going on, really? It's not reasonable that any of these systems should be unexplained, that we shouldn't know how they work. In fact, it's really important that we do. anything's going to be, if anybody's going to be held accountable, then it really is important to have a grip on it. As in fairness, they said earlier on, like the man said, you need to know how it works. Who exactly is accountable and on what terms? And then we need to be able to hold people to it, don't we? But such information is, as we know, nowadays available, which is really great, but it can be a bit hard to come by. Having said that, about, you know, the generous pay and perks and stuff, the movie, Brexit the movie, makes clear how much extra gravy is getting served with the EU meal, and it is really quite staggering. Again, something that comes out in the private eye quite a lot, this. But they get allowances, apparently, for relocation, for household expenses, family costs, entertainment, private healthcare, God help her, mate, and private education for the offspring. So that must stack up pretty nicely, mustn't it? And then apparently in the case of the MEPs, this is on top of £250 a day just for turning up. £250 a day just for turning up. Wow, I'll have to work a bit to get that. £41,000 towards phones and admin. 41 grand on phones and admin, eh? Perhaps the whole team's up every night of the week playing World of Warcraft or something like that. What do you reckon? I don't know. And then a whopping £225,000, as far as I gather, a year for staff. With all of that, you really wouldn't need actually to do any work, would you? Which is just as well, because I don't think they actually do any work. I mean, that's really wicked, eh? I mean, shit. What a way to run anything. What a way to run anything. Apparently they've got some 50,000 employed on this kind of basis. And, you know, there's these little blue starry plates attached to practically every building, practice and project in the EU. It should be really quite clear that the money required to do all of this, pay all these people and get all these little blue plaques on things, it really can't be raised simply by taxation. Which I think is how most people, I think that's where most people think all the money comes from. When you look at how much is being spent, well, it can't be, can it? But then we don't really know about the financial side of things in the EU because the auditors have refused to sign off the books for well over a decade. The auditors, you know, who happily rode clients through the wholly unforeseen crashes of the past and oversaw such crackingly sound outings as, BCCI, Polypec, the laundering of Mexican drug money through UK PLC's high street banks, all those dodgy mortgage sales running up to 2008, and these people are refusing to make their mark where it is needed. Oh dear, do you think we could safely assume that, unaudited, a thing the size of the imaginary European Union is going to be a fair old shambles? I think it is. Like I say, it isn't, I don't think, simply a matter of getting in or out. It's really a matter of much, much more, much, much more urgent and a radical surgery, as I suspect, needed than that. And also, if it's not done voluntarily, it will happen as a matter of course. And perhaps it's worth bearing in mind that British democracy, good old British democracy, is much, much older, much older. And thus is, in all likelihood, in my experience, gonna be an even bigger shambles. Because having been there that long, it won't really be possible to come up with an honest audit, would be my suspicion. And I doubt very much that anybody's trying. I mean, when they had that expenses scandal, it only came about because somebody suddenly decided to audit something that hadn't been audited for decades. And, oh my God, look, there's everybody caught with their pants down well and truly. Not only is it older, of course, the British democracy, but there is this wicked rumour going around that suggests that it's been trading whilst insolvent for the last few centuries. Now, there's a stunt that can't be easily pulled off with any honesty, I'd have thought. There you go. The narrator points out that EU regulation seems absurd and intrusive. We don't like being bossed around by a bunch of bureaucrats. For the British, it seems to go against the grain, he seems to believe. Does it now? And how many of those British are currently deployed by various arms of the state to disturb, charge, and otherwise inconvenience men and women who are causing other men and women no harm? Hey, how many of them are there? Quite a few now, certainly around here. And taking the corporation's shilling for so doing. And you know, in the wider population, how many people do you see, say, smoking in pubs or not paying a wholly unenforceable private parking ticket? Not many. We, the British, in fact, you know, don't like regulation. It seems to me that we're all too ready to stand in line. We're kind of famous for it, aren't we? Quite apart from anything else, it seems to me that many of us behave as if we positively enjoy being bossed around by anyone with a fluoro jacket, let alone a bureaucrat with a pen and a clipboard. I'm not sure how many of the people who behave that way actually do enjoy it, but it'd be a start if those who don't enjoy it started behaving differently. Apparently, the British freed themselves from suffocating feudal regulations centuries before the Europeans, you'll be glad to hear. While serfdom still existed in large parts of Europe, the free British were carrying out the great commercial and industrial revolution that gave birth to the modern world. Very good. I like that bit. You know, wasn't this actually the point at which the private banks and stockholding and insurance and inflation and interest and income tax and all that guff really started to take a hold? I think it was. These are the instruments of modern serfdom, which, like slavery, I don't agree with him, like slavery, it never really went away. Its form might have changed a little bit, but years of messing with it, I used to call it the new feudalism, but some time ago, me and Synchro, we realised it's just feudalism. That's what it is. If a man with a sword is taking money from a man without a sword and giving it to a man with a crown, and if the man with no sword and no crown also has no access to land, well, that's pretty much feudalism, isn't it? Pretty much. And as for giving birth to the modern world, I'll bet we've forgotten more than the sum of what we think we know over time as we've come from wherever it was that we were. And the modern world, quite apart from anything else, is clearly something of an iffy project. Surely only a strange person is going to want to lay claim to being its midwife. Takes all sorts. And all thanks to the free British, eh? Marvellous. The latter half of Brexit, this is also quite amusing, I thought this made me chuckle, because the latter half of the movie details the price-fixing protectionism and support for failing industries that manifested really not so long ago. I remember this, and it manifested as a result of what were then the policies of domestic United Kingdom government. Price-fixing, protectionism, and support for failing industries. Suggests that at least sometimes you can't slip a Rizzler between the one thing and the other, eh? And according to Dr. Eamon Butler from the Adam Smith Institute, the EU elite think that the ordinary people need to be controlled and looked after. They think the world needs to be ordered from above. Well, there's nothing new in that principle, for sure. As I've mentioned before, it seems to me that management or government, whatever we want to call it, leads to impaired performance, especially when it's operating to the exclusion of ingenuity, cooperation and self-leadership, all of which seem to me to lead to better results. Perhaps till now we've needed governing, I wouldn't know, but the top-down hierarchical structure has brought us to where we are, because it's all we've had, really. It was a couple of, you know, tiny little smidgens of other things that occurred along the way, but fairly quickly got stamped on or taxed out of existence. And it's not just the hierarchical structure, it's commitment to the bottom line, commitment to profit, with literally no consideration of social or environmental consequences. And of course, that way anybody who has got any social or environmental, conscience, can only play catch up. And again, the EU is simply the latest, largest manifestation of what it seems to be is basically some kind of strategy for wrecking a planet. So apparently we get from Europe rules upon rules upon rules, such that no reasonable human being could now possibly have an understanding of all the rules they need to obey. Even the EU is unable to tell us how many laws there are. Well, I shouldn't think the UK government could tell us how many laws there are either. I mean, you know, does that sound familiar? Rules upon rules upon rules. No chance of keeping up. Sounds dead familiar to me. There's been legislation drafted in this estate for hundreds of years, you know. Recent governments, notably Mr. Blair's, but he wasn't alone, have been notorious for the sheer quantity of new statutes produced each year. I went looking once, I did try to find out, and went for the simple, how many statutes are there, search in my favourite search engine, and It asked me whether I meant how many statues are there, and then went on to tell me that there was only one Statue of Liberty. Well, thank you, Mr. Google, for that. Most useful. There are, I mean, you know, uncountable statues, not only in Europe, but here, and now, of course, we're generating them in, I'm sure they're being generated in Cardiff as well. So, the reason why ignorance of the law is no excuse is because we all know to cause no harm. Most of us do. Some of the people in charge, it seems to be nominally in charge, it seems to be a bit of a challenge too, but most of us know to cause no harm. And that is the only law. Ignorance of legislation, whether of the European or of multi-layered, fractally multiplying domestic kind, is unavoidable. It doesn't matter how your government's chosen or where it's imagined to reside. If you've got one, you're going to be having trouble with all of these rules generating themselves. EU, again, or no EU. It's pointed out that the EU constantly wants to achieve growth through harmonisation, top-down control and central direction, and we know these don't work, they say. Yes, well, we do. And yet we've got a single, you know, a national curriculum, say. That's harmonisation, isn't it? Domestically arising, top-down control is definitely what we get. There's not a lot of bottom-up feedback in the system. Kept to a minimum, I would say, and being minimised all the time. Central direction, being told what to do. And we do know these things don't work. Well, more to the point, we know that if people are actually allowed to work together to come up with solutions, they work a lot better. You know, too right. We've had a few thousand years or so to sort that one out. But I'm struggling to think of a place in the world which isn't governed using just those principles. Harmonisation, top-down control and central direction. Anywhere. Think of anywhere. And yet, he says, we know they don't work. So I can't really see that leaving the EU is going to help much on that score. And to close, he says, despite, well, not quite to close, there's more in the movie, but I got a bit bored then. Despite decades of economic decline, the EU elite carries on regardless. They're unmoved by criticism, untroubled by popular discontent. There we go, and everyone lived happily ever after. But perhaps if people were not relying only on their supposed vote to change things, and were instead acting as if what is being done in their name is unacceptable, and if we were seeking ways of governing our lives that make not just the EU but all government less central to each of our individual lives, I think perhaps we might start making a bit more progress. It seems to me that the cross on the piece of paper isn't necessarily doing the job. It seems to me also that we've been lulled into a situation where, quite clearly now, to almost everybody, all hell is breaking loose. You know, and in the centre of that loose breaking, fundamentally, are money at the root, commerce, and government. Of course, with the more or less willing support of millions of men and women. But money, commerce, and government, and the men and women that activate them, are clearly, undeniably, and almost exclusively encouraging the flames of hell, as far as I can see, you know, and whether they're in London or in Cardiff or in the EU. You can see that these people's description of the EU can be pretty easily applied to what's going on here, you know. Do we really want to encourage them? Do we really want to encourage any of them? You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, and that was Litmus and No Tax for War. Litmus's work can be reviewed on his fabulous site, projectfreeman.com, where he looks into and records all of his various experimentation and investigation of the state of the state in which we live. And before that, Motorhead and No Class. I can't imagine why it should occur to me to play No Class when I've been talking about our excellent, top-notch, five-star public servants. And look at that, we've actually got a bit of time to consider, perhaps, one or two local applications of Europe as I've experienced it over the years, being a gardener. It's a pretty good place to look, actually. When it first came about, the free movement of people and capital over borders seemed like a great idea and a good enough excuse for entering the European project, and it was completely brilliant to be able to ride your motorbike over, you know, France and Holland and Germany, and not have to encounter a border until one got all the way to what had just become the Czech Republic. That was absolutely great, totally brilliant. What we were after, I was also working as a logistics manager at the time, so we were importing stuff from and exporting stuff to most of the countries in the European Union anyway, as well as many other places in the world. And it was a total pain in the arse. There was just absolutely shed loads of paperwork involved. And all of that paperwork for all the European companies just pretty much disappeared overnight and made it all a lot quicker and easier, which was really great. However, we did have to provide a report as a result of this to a European body, I believe, known as Intrastat. And they turned out telephone directory, for those of you who can remember those, a telephone directory sized volume of 12-digit codes, which basically classified everything that was moving around, everything from sea snails to condoms. It had its code. And we were expected to report on everything that we imported from European countries. We had to tell them what it was, where it came from, what it was worth, how much it weighed. And we had to sum all of that stuff up for every month and report on it. And, of course, all the stuff that we'd exported to all of the various companies in Europe and countries in Europe had to be reported on as well. Now, that was one example of a total pain in the arse. So it was really easy, relatively speaking, to actually move the goods. But there was a whole load of administrative stuff that arose, which meant we were spending almost as much time reporting on and recording the stuff we were doing as we were spending actually doing it. And it became clear fairly quickly that that was what was going on. So I'm not sure how much time, effort, energy, paperwork, computer time, etc. was actually saved by that operation in the long run. And of course it's handing over a whole load of data for potential future control, taxing, charging, whatever might arise. But the thing that really hit me about Europe was the disappearance of a whole load of safe and home-produced weed and pest controllers for the garden. So I used to use a thing called Bacillus thunbergii, which is a naturally occurring bacteria that kills caterpillars when they eat the plant that have been sprayed with it. It's kind of living organism. It doesn't survive cooking or anything like that. And it meant that you could tip a sachet of this stuff in a watering can, put it over your brassicas, and you would have much, much, much reduced problems with things like the cabbage white butterfly. Ammonium sulfamate disappeared. It was a crystal weed killer that I think is still usable for all manner of things, including tanning. But according to the European Union, it became unlicensed in 2008 because it hadn't been tested to make sure that it was actually safe for human use. It was a particularly effective killer. It killed stumps and brambles and all manner of stuff, really good broad-spectrum stuff. And as far as I can understand, your ammonium sulfamate, after about 3 or 4 weeks, actually turns into some kind of potash food for the plants. It was never shown, I believe, to have had any seriously deleterious effects on human beings, although, of course, I'm not sure what would happen if you actually drank some of it. Probably wouldn't do you any good. But general contact and all of that didn't seem to do too much harm. We also used to have a marvellous array of things like pyrethrums and deris and stuff like that that we could use, a lot of which have now disappeared. I'm not sure to tell you the truth which ones are still out there. But we also had a whole mass of stuff that we could make at home from plants, things like chamomile maceration spray, horsetail infusion sprays, nettle manure spray, pyrethrum spray. All of these things, because they haven't actually been tested by whichever department in the EU it is that's supposed to test these things, became unapproved for use. As is said in Gwydion's Planting Guide, one of my favourite little manuals on these things, he says that due to current legislation, all homemade remedies are simply foliar applications. Their specific use is being stated for historical interest only. It is illegal to use them or advise their use because they cannot be precisely quantified or regulated. It's illegal to use them or advise their use because they cannot be precisely quantified or regulated. Not, you notice, because they're not safe. Please use expensive toxic sprays instead, as preferred by inflexible bureaucrats who would be better employed turning over your manure heap. Quite so. Well, all of that, of course, would be totally fine if it wasn't for the fact that things that can be easily quantified and regulated do seem to find their way in. There's a big argument going on at the moment as to whether our farmers should be given emergency permission to use neonicotine-based pest killers. We already use under emergency legislation, which is reintroduced every year, a banned chemical killer which is sprayed over the countryside in an attempt to control bracken. And it appears that there's another move on the glyphosate, which is most certainly not a safe weed killer. Synchro and I were exposed to it more than we would have liked last year for one reason or another, and both of us actually became pretty sick from symptoms that are described in some of the more interesting journal reports on glyphosate. We've stopped using it. We've taken a lot of Clive DeCarle's advice and have been taking things which I now know actually directly work against the kind of poisoning that I was having, which is why I'm probably feeling a lot better than I was, as it has to be said, as synchro. In the newsletter from our organic news gardening catalogue, there's a little title which says more confusion over glyphosate. Glyphosate, which is of course a weed killer, a systemic weed killer, has been given a clean bill of health by the UN's joint meeting on pesticide residues, 2 days before a crunch EU vote on whether to relicense it. This finding contradicts an assessment by the World Health Organization's Cancer Agency last year that the herbicide solution was probably carcinogenic to humans. Garden Organic strongly opposes the relicensing of glyphosate and thinks the differing reports are creating confusion for consumers. The only way to be sure is to avoid its use altogether. So I thought, well, let's have a quick look, shall we, and see if there's, this is all pretty recent, if there's going to be an EU vote, let's see what's going on. I found it actually not possible to pick up one of those chemical sheets that comes with glyphosate, and that's because glyphosate is always mixed with other things that make it easier for the plant to take it up. So the result is, quite possibly, some of the technical information we need somehow seems to avoid actually finding its way into the public domain. But there is a very useful little website called glyphosate.eu, which seems to be European information on glyphosate. And this is what it says. It says, since glyphosate was first introduced nearly 40 years ago, it has been subjected to hundreds of laboratory and field research studies to assess its impact on human health and the environment. Because glyphosate has been widely adopted for weed control in agriculture, practically universally, I'd say, industry and home gardens, it has become perhaps the most widely studied active ingredient used in herbicidal products, being the subject of hundreds of scientific publications. In the EU, it was approved in 2002 for a period of 10 years. The human health evaluation was based on the results of over 200 toxicology studies. The overall conclusion from that evaluation was that glyphosate meets all the safety requirements laid down by all relevant EU directives for herbicides and poses no unacceptable risk to human health. This view has so far been confirmed by all subsequent safety evaluations conducted by official regulatory agencies, as well as by the new regulatory dossier submitted for the ongoing evaluation process of glyphosate in 2012, which includes new studies carried out to the latest guidelines. The human safety evaluation of glyphosate was based on the results of oral, dermal, and inhalation toxicity studies, as well as feeding experiments in rats, mice, rabbits, and dogs. Additionally, chronic and genotoxicological studies assessed possible effects of glyphosate on the development and the DNA of mammals. Reviews of these tests concluded that glyphosate has only very little acute toxicity. It is not carcinogenic and does not have mutagenic effects, i.e. it does not alter DNA. Glyphosate, when ingested, is not metabolized and is rapidly eliminated, primarily unchanged, from the body. It is poorly absorbed through the skin and does not accumulate in animal tissues. Glyphosate is not detrimental to the reproduction or development of test animals. A number of studies in rats and rabbits found no indication of any specific hazard posed by glyphosate for reproduction or development of the offspring. Although a reduced pup weight was observed in some cases, this was only seen at very high dose levels, which were several thousand times higher than the predicted daily intake for humans. Glyphosate did not interfere with endocrine or hormone systems in a wide variety of studies in animals.
Glyphosate did not interfere with endocrine systems in a wide variety of studies in animals. So an implication there that in another wide variety it possibly did. Once again, like I say, I'm just a suspicious old git nowadays. Okay, so that's what they say. Doesn't sound very likely at all, does it? Any of that, really, not given what we know. Well, according to one of my regular sources of information on such things, which is Mercola.com, Dr. Mercola's site, he's got an article saying Monsanto's Roundup herbicide may be the most important factor in the development of autism and other chronic disease. In recent weeks, this article says we've learned some very disturbing truths about glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's broad-spectrum herbicide Roundup, which is generously doused on genetically engineered Roundup-ready crops. A new peer-reviewed report authored by Anthony Samsell, a retired science consultant and a long-time contributor to the Mercola.com Vital Votes Forum, and Dr. Stephanie Seneff, a research scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, reveals how glyphosate wrecks human health. In the interview above, Dr. Seneff summarizes the two key problems caused by glyphosate in the diet: nutritional deficiencies and systemic toxicity. Their findings make the need for labeling all the more urgent and the advice to buy certified organic all the more valid. In 2009, a French court found Monsanto guilty of lying, falsely advertising its Roundup herbicide as biodegradable, environmentally friendly, and claiming it left the soil clean. Mounting evidence now tells us how false such statements are. I don't believe that Monsanto is one of the most evil companies on the planet for nothing. The company has done absolutely nothing to improve their worldwide influence on human and environmental health. In a video above, Jeffrey Smith, author of the bestseller Seeds of Deception, says Monsanto, during some reflective moment, must have asked, what would Darth Vader do? Because what they've come up with is a way of pretending that they're beneficial and then insinuating themselves into the food and agriculture industry. And now it turns out that what they have is very, very dangerous. Indeed, according to Dr. Seneff, glyphosate is possibly the most important factor in the development of multiple chronic diseases and conditions that have become prevalent in westernized societies, including but not limited to autism, obesities, allergies, cardiovascular disease, depression, cancer, infertility, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, ALS, gastrointestinal diseases such as IBS, chronic diarrhea, colitis, and Crohn's disease. So that's not exactly in line with what we just heard from glyphosate.eu, is it? And that is because, rather cleverly, I think, as he describes here, glyphosate.eu is dealing with glyphosate, whereas what we're dealing with is the effect of the products that have glyphosate in them, so they're chemical combinations. So how glyphosate worsens modern diseases, it says. While Monsanto insists that Roundup is as safe to humans as aspirin, Sanseff and Samsell's research tells a different story altogether. Their report, published in the journal Entropy, argues that glyphosate residues found in most commonly consumed foods in the Western diet, courtesy of genetically engineered sugar, corn, soy, and wheat, quote, enhance the damaging effects of other foodborne chemical residues and toxins in the environment to disrupt normal body functions and induce disease, close quote. Interestingly, your gut bacteria are a key component of glyphosate's mechanism of harm, and that, folks, was exactly what I experienced. My gut bacteria just disappeared, and everything became pretty chaotic for a while. The kombucha has really helped that, as did the probiotics in ancientpurity.com's package to me. Monsanto has steadfastly claimed that Roundup is harmless to animals and humans because the mechanism of action it uses, which allows it to kill weeds, called the shikimate pathway, is absent in all animals. However, the shikimate pathway is present in bacteria, and that's the key to understanding how it causes such widespread systemic harm in both humans and animals. The bacteria in your body outnumber your cells by 10 to 1. For every cell in your body, you have 10 microbes of various kinds, and all of them have the shikimate pathway. It's S-H-I-K-I-M-A-T-E, however we say it. So they will all respond to the presence of glyphosate. Glyphosate causes extreme disruption of the microbes' function and life cycle. What's worse, glyphosate preferentially affects beneficial bacteria, allowing pathogens to overgrow and take over. At that point, your body also has to contend with the toxins produced by the pathogens. Once the chronic inflammation sets in, you're well on your way toward chronic and potentially debilitating disease. In the interview above, Dr. Seneff reviews a variety of chronic diseases, explaining how glyphosate contributes to each condition. So to learn more, I urge you to listen to it in its entirety. It's quite eye-opening. This is in articles.mercola.com, M-E-R-C-O-L-A.com, because obviously I'm not actually here, even though you can hear me, so I can't post a link into the chat box. But go to mercola.com and put Monsanto Roundup herbicide in, and you'll come up with this rather disturbing article. The research reveals that glyphosate inhibits enzymes called P4550-CYP, a large and diverse group of enzymes that catalyze the oxidation of organic substances. This, the authors state, is an overlooked component of its toxicity to mammals. One of the functions of CYP enzymes is to detoxify xenobiotics, chemical compounds found in a living organism that are not normally produced or consumed by the organism in question. By limiting the ability of these enzymes to detoxify foreign chemical compounds, glyphosate enhances the damaging effects of chemicals and environmental toxins you may be exposed to. And Lord knows, we are being exposed to an enormous number of chemicals and environmental toxins. And according to this, glyphosate enhances the damaging effects of such things. That's not all. Dr. Stephanie Seneff has been conducting research at MIT for over 3 decades. She also has an undergraduate degree in biology from MIT and a minor in food and nutrition, and I've previously interviewed her about her groundbreaking insights into the critical importance of sulfur in human health, which again was one of the things that I was taking in some quantity as a result of the ancient purity stuff. Not surprisingly, this latest research also touches on sulfur and how it is affected by glyphosate from food. We show how interference with CYP enzymes acts synergistically with disruption of the biosynthesis of aromatic amino acids by gut bacteria, as well as impairment in serum sulfate transport, the authors write. Consequences are most of the diseases and conditions associated with a Western diet, which include gastrointestinal disorders, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, all the ones we listed early on. The recent alarming increase in all of these health issues can be traced back to a combination of gut dysbiosis, impaired sulfate transport, and suppression of the activity of the various members of the cytochrome P450 family of enzymes. There you go. The article goes on to deal with the Roundup autism connection, which Dr. Seneff has also been looking at, and she's got an absolutely amazing graph which shows a red line on the introduction and use of glyphosate and then a bar chart showing how many cases of autism have arisen in such areas, and the red line follows pretty much absolutely the bar chart. So when food is poison, what the biotech industry spearheaded by Monsanto has managed to do is turn food into poison, quite literally and in more ways than one. Here, we're just talking about the effects of Roundup. There are plenty of indications that the genetic alteration of a crop itself can pose significant health concerns. So with the vast majority of genetically engineered crops, you have no less than 2 potentially hazard factors to contend with, glyphosate toxicity being just one part of that equation. As discussed above, glyphosate has a number of devastating biological effects, so much so that it may very well be one of the most important factors in the development of a wide variety of modern diseases and conditions, including autism. In summary, these detrimental effects include nutritional deficiencies, as glyphosate immobilizes certain nutrients and alters the nutritional composition of the treated crop. Increased toxin exposure. This includes high levels of glyphosate and formaldehyde actually in the food itself. Systemic toxicity, a side effect of extreme disruption of microbial function throughout your body, beneficial microbes in particular, allowing for overgrowth of pathogens. Enhancement of damaging effects of other foodborne chemical residues and environmental toxins as a result of glyphosate shutting down the function of detoxifying enzymes. Disruption of the biosynthesis of aromatic amino acids. These are essential amino acids not produced in your body that must be supplied via your diet. impairment of sulfate transport and sulfur metabolism, and sulfate deficiency as a result. Gut dysbiosis, imbalances in gut bacteria, inflammation, food allergies such as gluten intolerance. Creation of ammonia, a byproduct created when certain microbes break down glyphosate, which can lead to brain inflammation associated with autism and Alzheimer's disease. So that's what Dr. Mercola thinks. He doesn't think, clearly, or those researchers don't think, that it has very little acute toxicity, and whether it's poorly absorbed through the skin and does not accumulate in animal tissues is more or less irrelevant if it's actually accumulating in all of the all of your gut bacteria and all that kind of stuff. Glyphosate does not interfere with endocrine systems in any way. Well, you know, who do you believe? Do you believe glyphosate.eu or do you believe Dr. Mercola? And having heard what the EU have got to say on the matter at glyphosate.eu and what Mercola and those two researchers have got to say, how much of the rest of the stuff do you think we can trust that these people are putting out? In or out my ass. Well, there you go. So it seems we've come to the end of another show, more or less, I expect, by now. I'll be back with you live next week. Hopefully we won't be disappearing for any more Thursdays. And hopefully in the not-too-distant future I'm going to be talking to Simon Spaniard about insurance, which should be an interesting conversation. I'll be talking to a character I met at Fire in the Mountain called Nick Hunt, about a project that he's set up called the Dark Mountain Press, which is, he's taken a right kicking apparently for talking about the fact that the whole thing looks like it's really seriously damaged and needs some attention. Apparently, there's a whole bunch of people out there who just don't even want to talk about that, so that should be an interesting conversation. Also, we'll be having conversations about complementary health, land rights, and the history of rebellion. All of these things coming up on future Dr. Rock shows, but for now, we're going to play out with another couple of tunes. We'll include Sell Out from The Levellers, I'm going to play next, and a bit of little bit of Local Colour. There Ain't No Bus to Freedom from Little Rumba, a band from around here. So thanks to all of you for listening. Should have joined you in the chat box by now, hopefully, and I'll see you all next week. Cheers, folks.